Science is interesting, and if you don't agree, you can fuck off.
Yeah, that's still making Ellen smile every single time.
Every time, without
you
fail.
I just love this one. All right, so how are you today, Ellen?
I'm very well, thank you, Lisa.
How are classes going? Everything all good?
Oh, they're tough, you know, but, you know, we soldier on, so, yeah.
All right, all good. Well, let's start the chat then. Mm-hmm. So, some potentially worrying news, actually, for those of us who like to enjoy the sun while being protected from it. I am obviously talking about sunscreen users. Mm-hmm. Tell us a bit more about that.
Okay, well, very, very topical this, because I just went to the doctor this morning and got a little lump checked out just to make sure that it wasn't melanoma, and it wasn't. So,
okay,
so
great.
That's all good. Yeah.
That started by worrying me a little bit.
So,
not sure you would have said it this way, though.
No, indeed. So, sunscreen. So, how do they work and what do they do and everything? We take them for granted. I guess you go out in the sun these days, you have to get covered up in sunscreen. It's just a no-brainer. And, you know, the higher SPF, the better.
Mm.
So, it's kind of interesting because just very, very recently, the governor of Hawaii decided to ban sunscreens that contained particular compounds on the basis that they were not good for coral reefs.
Okay, so has there been a study about this? Or?
Yeah, by all accounts. And that's kind of a worry, really, because, well, I guess your average person doesn't put that much sunscreen on when they go into the water. You'd have to have a truckload of people there to make a difference, you would have thought, but this is what they've done. So,
okay. Is it specific brands?
Yeah, so there's specific molecules within that do the actual capturing of the UV rays and stop them getting to you. So those molecules have been implicated in damage to coral reefs. And so, you know, better safe than sorry sort of thing. So they are now banning those, and which means that these manufacturers are going to have to look for alternatives in order to, you know, keep selling sunscreens. And sunscreens are quite difficult to get on market, certainly in the States anyway, because they've got to be FDA approved, Federal Drug Administration.
Yeah.
And so therefore, that means that that's an awful lot of time.
Mm.
And of course, with the awful lot of time goes an awful lot of money as well. Yeah. So, people are looking for alternatives to the so-called man-made, quote-unquote, sunscreens. and so they've started to look to nature for inspiration in this, because it's not only humans that need protection from the sun, it's, you know, everything that's alive as well. So all your plants and animals and all those sorts of things. So how do they...
Nature always has an answer anyway.
Most of the time, yeah. Nature's, mind you, they've had about a 4.5 billion year head start on you know, good old Homo sapiens. Yeah. So there's nothing like natural, is it? You know, that's a good word. You know, if you want to sell stuff, you just say it's natural and everything and blah, 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 blah. So plants have one of two ways of essentially stopping ultraviolet rays doing damage to them. And one is sort of a physical barrier. So they use, like on leaves, you'll see a thick waxy sort of cuticle on leaves and stuff.
Okay.
And that acts as a sort of physical barrier to stop the UV radiation getting through. Or you can use sort of organic molecules. Now, if you're not a tree or whatever and got leaves, then you can't use this sort of physical barrier. So there's things like algae and stuff like that that don't have this protective sort of waxy barrier. And so they've got to use organic molecules to absorb the ultraviolet radiation.
Okay.
So in terms of people, again, there's two ways that you can stop UV radiation. So you can use sunscreen, which, you know, is sort of this liquid stuff that you slop all over you, and that's full of these organic molecules that actually absorb the light and or the ultraviolet radiation, which is just light anyway, and render it harmless. Or you can use, again, a physical barrier. So something like titanium dioxide or zinc oxide, so that stuff that you put on your nose, all the crickets put on their nose and stuff like that. So those are a whole lot of tiny little particles of stuff that actually essentially reflect the ultraviolet light and get it away. And there's been some questions raised over the safety of those as well, for the fact that, yeah, the ultraviolet light might be doing something nasty and you might get these free radicals and stuff. And so I've got a mate at University College London who actually studies this sort of thing, and he won't let his kids anywhere near anything that's got zinc oxide or titanium dioxide. He just does not like those sunscreens at all. He reckons they do more damage than they do good. So we've got these organic molecules. So that's what we want. We want organic molecules going to absorb the radiation and basically render it harmless. So what they are doing is looking at these algae that have got these particular organic molecules in them. They extract these molecules, they have a look at them, look at what the structure is, and then the trick is to now go and put those into sunscreens and call them all natural, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah.
Brilliant in theory. Trouble is the algae, this particular algae, surprise, surprise, is, well, quite surprising actually, is slow growing, which is not normally what you think of algae. Yeah. They normally sort of, you know.
Well, that's bad luck. That's, you know. Oh,
so it takes a year to get to the point where you can harvest this stuff. Good question. I didn't swat up on that one.
Come on, Harry.
I was going to say, is it in Hawaii where they're banning it?
No, it's not. No, it's not Hawaii. I'm pretty sure it's the States, but don't quote me on that.
So what you're saying is that because they're slow growing, it's...
Then it's going to be difficult to get
it. Use it to, yeah.
Yeah. So what they've done a little bit of genetic manipulation with these things, and now they can get it in 2 weeks, which is brilliant.
Perfect.
Okay. Of course, you know, the genetic manipulation thing does sort of cause problems amongst some of the public, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah.
And so what other people are doing are taking those particular molecules and using them sort of as inspiration to design new molecules that will do the job. So these ones that come from the algae, they are difficult to make. They're going to be expensive. They're not going to be commercially viable. So we want cheaper ones that are based on that scaffold, essentially. So they know what bits of the molecules do the job.
And we can just artificially create it.
Exactly. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Yeah. So it's based on sort of natural things, but made in the lab. So, you know, it's the next best thing to all natural, quote unquote, I guess. But very, very interesting. I had no idea that really sunscreen did this to coral reefs.
Quite game-changing, really, especially being from New Zealand where sunscreen is so blasted everywhere.
Yes, yeah.
I mean, we're told from a very early age that you must wear sunscreen.
And again, I mean, if you read Consumer Magazine or whatever, they do sort of periodic tests on sunscreens, and some of them just fail the tests at all. And most of those ones, unfortunately, are ones that are described as being all natural, you know, no chemicals, really? All that crap.
Mm.
Yeah.
I mean,
so, yeah, you got to be careful. You got to, yeah, I guess sort of take good advice as to what to use and everything. So, yeah.
Well, hopefully that happens in the near future and we can have safe sunscreen for people and the environment.
Here, here.
How great would that
Agreed.
Be?
Agreed. Yes.
All right. Moving on to our next topic. It is a New Zealand academic that worked on the aging of galaxies, and she's been sort of forgotten by history.
Yeah, interesting one, this one. Now, I guess this sort of links into the first story in terms of melanoma, as you will see.
Okay.
But what drew me to this was the fact that, just having a quick squiz through the New York Times, as one does, you know, very occasionally, they've got this new series on obituaries of people whose obituary they missed first time around, essentially.
Okay. Oh, it's like they missed the death, and they're like, we should have done something about this.
Basically, yeah, basically, people maybe who weren't famous enough when they died, but whose reputation has sort of increased since they died.
That's a good segment. Mm. Yeah. I think that's pretty interesting.
And so one of these was Beatrice Tinsley, and hopefully some listeners might be familiar with that name. So she was a New Zealand raised, not born, but raised physicist who ended up being the first female astronomy professor at Yale University, which is
quite quite an achievement.
Yeah, yeah.
And what sort of time period are we talking?
Well, she was born in 1941.
Okay.
And the folks emigrated out here. She was at a young age, I guess. And so she was schooled in New Plymouth and went to New Plymouth Girls High, I believe, or something, and was about the only girl who had ever done scholarship physics, I think, at that stage. Then went to Canterbury University and got a master's at Canterbury. Met her husband-to-be there. He was another physics student there. And so Beatrice Hill became Beatrice Tinsley. And then he was employed at Canterbury. She tried to get a job there and couldn't for some reason because her husband was employed there. I don't get that.
Okay, I don't see what that would have changed.
Yeah,
but
I know. That does. Well, I mean, this was, I guess, the 60s, I suppose, sort of early to mid 60s. So
it's a shame, though. You
know, well, shame.
If you happen to be two great minds and then only one can get a job.
Then where did she go?
Yeah, shame for New Zealand. So her husband was obviously pretty good because he was headhunted by University of Texas in Dallas.
Not too bad.
And so she went with him, and she decided to do her PhD at that time while he was there. And so she did her PhD at the University of Texas at Austin, which is about 700K away from Dallas. So that was a weekly commute thing, or, you know, that was a decent commute. And at that time also, they adopted two kids as well. So she was doing a PhD and sort of, you know,
commuting and then having children.
Yeah.
That's a lot of things.
So, and eventually, so her PhD was all about whether or not the universe was expanding. And nowadays we know that that's a fact, that it's expanding, and it's expanding at ever-increasing speeds, essentially. So back in those days, people thought, okay, there might have been this sort of Big Bang thing, and then the universe will get to a particular size, and then we'll have a thing called the Big Crunch, because it'll all just come in on itself and just sort of turn into that singularity again that it started off at. And some people thought that this sort of happened, you know, infinite number of times and everything. This is the way the universe was. And her PhD thesis showed for a fact that this was not the case. And so,
it's pretty groundbreaking.
Oh, shit, yeah. You know, that's remarkable stuff. And she very publicly took on one of the big astronomers in a public lecture, basically sort of telling the audience that the stuff that they were about to hear was complete bullshit, which is a pretty ballsy thing to do to an academic.
Yeah,
definitely.
But she was right. She was right. It got published, and then the year afterwards, this bigwig came round to her side and said, yep, you're right. And yeah, so, you know, she basically had the world at her feet, really, except for the fact that, again, she couldn't get a job at University of Texas. And so she made what must have been a hell of a gut-wrenching decision to basically leave her family, split up with a hubby, leave the two kids with him, and go and become the first female professor of astronomy at Yale, which, you know, I mean, everyone knows the name Yale. That's a big university.
Yeah.
And, you know, she had to make that choice.
Yeah, family, it's a shame to have to make
family
that
or profession
choice.
And she chose profession, I guess. And so she got sort of, you know, awards, you know, the best young female physicist on the planet, and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And then, I guess, a couple of years after she moved to Yale, very tragically, she had found a melanoma on her leg, and she died about 3 years later. And really, really, really tragic story, really. But she, I guess, is one of New Zealand's unsung heroes to a certain extent, although there is a street in Auckland named after her out Albany Way.
Is there?
Okay.
And so it very appropriately, it intersects Sir William Pickering Drive. And Sir William Pickering was another great Kiwi scientist who ended up spending all of his time in the States. And Ride Way, I think, was named after Sally Ride, the American female astronaut. Mm. So very appropriately placed street there. So,
yeah.
Definitely a woman worth remembering.
Oh, hell yeah. Mm. Yeah. Yeah. No, quite extraordinary. I mean, you know, she was 40 when she died. And, you know, you just...
Still achieved a lot.
If you're an academic, you're just getting into your best years at that stage. You know, mine are long gone. But, you know...
Don't say that.
But kind of interestingly, and I just looked this up, whatever happened to her husband? And he,
what happened to him?
Yeah, well, he is still a professor at, he's an emeritus professor at Texas still.
Okay.
And he has made enormous contributions into the area of climate change and stuff. So, you know, that's kind of an interesting sort of byproduct of the story and everything. So somebody who should definitely be remembered, you know, a great New Zealand scientist. And, you know, let's do something to commemorate her, I think.
Yeah,
she certainly deserves it.
Thanks for bringing our attention to her.
Yeah, well, thank the New York Times.
Yeah,
you know.
True. Yeah. I'll start looking into that section actually now.
Yeah, it's very good.
All right, so we only have maybe a couple of minutes to talk about that final topic and this great lady, Rosalind Franklin.
Yes, I know. It's her birthday today.
Yep.
And she would have been 98.
Exactly.
Today. Yes.
So what did she do
in
her lifetime?
I mean, we can't do this justice in 2 minutes. Goodness me.
Sorry. You're speaking too much.
No, I know. But anyway, okay, so everybody knows Watson and Crick. Well, hopefully everybody knows Watson and Crick are the names that are associated with the structure of DNA.
Yes.
Okay, and they won the Nobel Prize for that in concert with a New Zealand-born guy by the name of Maurice Wilkins. So all three of them won the Nobel Prize for the structure of DNA in physiology or medicine in 1962.
Mm-hmm.
Now, there was a fourth member of the team whose work was absolutely invaluable in determining the structure of DNA, and her name was Rosalind Franklin. And she was what's called an X-ray crystallographer. And long story short, you shoot X-rays at a at a compound, at a chemical compound, mm-hmm. at DNA, whatever. And the way that those X-rays bounce off it, you can figure out what the structure is. Okay?
Okay.
Down to the atomic resolution, you can figure out what atoms where in a particular molecule, which is just extraordinary. Don't have time to go into that. But. And in those days, it took forever. It took literally years to figure out what was going on with these things. Nowadays, you can do it in 5 minutes on a computer.
Mm.
And she was very slow, very methodical, and she had this really, really good data that she was sort of working through. And then Wilkins and Crick and Watson got a look at her data, and they thought, oh, I know what this means. And sort of on the basis of that, they built themselves a physical model of what they thought DNA looked like, and it was proven to be right. Mm. Now, she was very much against this sort of building model stuff. She wanted to work it out sort of herself and get it all sorted and everything, you know, using a brain and not using these models. And so they got the glory, they got the credit.
Yeah.
She unfortunately passed away in 1958. Prior to them receiving the Nobel Prize.
And there's now, Nobel Prizes post.
Right, there's no posthumous Nobel Prizes.
Hmm.
Okay, so chances are, had she lived, she surely would have been awarded the Nobel Prize jointly
with the team. Yeah,
with the team. Now, again, the other problem is that you can only get three at once. Okay, so the Nobel Prize, but she would have got it for chemistry or something like that.
Okay,
right. For surely. So, and there's a lot of controversy over this. Particular story, you know, allegations of sexism, allegations of the fact that Watson and Crick and Wilkins sort of stole her data without her knowing. What the truth is anybody's guess.
Yeah.
It does look like her data was shown to Watson and Crick, but then there's all sorts of stuff. I mean, if you're interested in this, you should certainly go and read the story, because it is a fascinating story, and again, a tragically early death.
Yeah.
You know,
was really that anything to do with the exposure to X-rays?
To X-rays, very possibly. She died of ovarian cancer. And obviously, too many X-rays around the place, are not too good for you. But again, absolutely astonishing scientist, and one taken far too soon. So, yeah.
Hmm.
Sorry, it's a bit morbid today.
Yeah.
Sorry.
Every time you do something about dead people, it's always a bit morbid, which happens more often than not. But it's okay. We still learn a lot of things, so that's all good.
Okay.
All right, well, thank you.
Not a problem.
For talking about these people, and we will see you next week.
Surely. Okay.
All right.
See you guys.
Thanks.
See ya.
Now, I'm turning this off. Here we go. we are going to have a little break. And we will be back very shortly.
That was Dear Science.
It will require a minor surgery, but there's nothing to worry about. We're lucky you came in so soon. Okay?
Cool. Yeah. I do have one design question, though.
Semi-permanent 2018, a three-day festival celebrating 15 years as a global leader in creativity and design. More than 50 creative thinkers, artists and designers here to speak and inspire. Semi-permanent 2018, August 9th to 11th, Aotea Centre, Auckland Central. For tickets and more information, go to semipermanent.com.
Hey, can you grab me some wine glasses?
Yep.
There aren't any.
There's never been a better time to buy glassware. The Glengarry Glassware Sale is on now. New Zealand's biggest range of wine-specific glassware, all on special, with up to 65% off brands including Riedel, Aish, Nachtmann and much more. The Glengarry Glassware Sale starts tomorrow in Sunday, Auckland-wide.
Hey, 95BFM, why are other radio stations so shit?
Because they're all run by Ayn Rand devil creatures.
Oh, you reckon?
Not 95BFM, we're a charity and we make that good, good content you crave with the help of generous people like you.
Me?
By signing up for a Simplicity B-card, you help keep BFM alive, independent and not shit. And as a thank you, you get sweet discounts from some of our mates. Ace, support independent media from as little as $4.20 a month with a Simplicity B-card. Go to 95bfm.com/sign-up.
Now it's time for Jenny Marcroft from the New Zealand First Party.
Hello there. After a month or so hiatus, we return to our New Zealand First segment. This week, speaking not with Jenny Marcroft, but with Tracy Martin, Minister for Internal Affairs and Associate Minister of Education. This morning, we touched on the inquiry into the State Services Commission appointment of the Deputy Police Commissioner, Wally Haumaha, and also we talked about New Zealand First turning 25 years old.
Hi, Harry. How are you?
Very good. How are you going this morning?
Not too bad. Thank you very much.
It's very good to hear. So I thought we could start off this morning talking about the inquiry into the State Service Commission appointment process of the Deputy Commissioner of Police, Wally Haumaha. So a few days ago, you did announce the terms of the reference. I was hoping you could just start off by telling me a little bit about the purpose of the inquiry. What will the terms of reference be focusing on here?
Sure. So mostly this is about the process. At the end of the day, what we're asking Dr. Pauline Kingi to do is to go away and have a look at the process and come back with an answer for us around what is the information that the State Services Commission should be expected to provide, what is the level of information that the State Services Commission should realistically be able to find out, what information should be given to a minister, along with any other recommendations around appointments. And if there is a filtering mechanism, what is it and why is it? So really, this particular inquiry is around the process that led to a particular appointment.
I mean, it's clear that there's been some issue that's happened. I mean, whether or not it was that the minister was told about Haumaha's previous comments. I mean, do you think that it's likely someone is going to be losing their job here?
I don't really know. I don't want to preempt what is the Dr. Pauline Kingi's inquiry. I mean, that's one of the reasons why we've made it an independent government inquiry, is so that, you know, there can be no suggestion that politicians are getting into this and trying to muck it about, which is what has been suggested by the opposition. So, you know, we specifically have made it an independent inquiry. A person who's not, I don't think, could be criticised in any way, shape or form for her skills or her work ethic.
Tell me about it, Pauline Kingi. Why did you select her to lead the inquiry?
Well, Ms. Kingi, apart from being, you know, highly respected for the career that she has had, she's an incredibly smart woman who did her degrees and so on at Harvard. She's highly recognised both inside of the Māori world and inside the sort of the Pākehā world. She's known to be a very tough operator, so she doesn't get pushed around by people. And I think that's what we needed here. We need a person who has, because this is a six-week inquiry, so it's a very condensed period of time. We understand the public interest. And so she, you know, the chair needed to get in there, ask the questions, not be frightened to go and ask some hard questions of some people quite high up in the State Services Commission and get answers for us.
Do you think it's likely she will be pushed around a little bit?
No, I don't. Not with this particular chair, no.
Okay. I mean, looking at what the National Party have been saying, do you think that they're valid in their claims that... So they said there's a conflict of interest in your appointment to the head of the inquiry as a New Zealand First MP, and Wally himself, who put his hand up for New Zealand First candidacy in 2005.
Has somebody proven that, have they?
I think that there were clippings from a New Zealand Herald article that showed he was running for Rotorua seat.
So when something appears in the newspaper, are we assuming that it's true? I've seen many things attributed to me, or I've been at many incidents that I've then seen, you know, events that I've then seen reported, that there is very little correlation between what I experienced and what has ended up in the paper.
Right.
So that's the first thing. I mean, I don't know. I think it's something we teach our young people quite a lot, is actually verify from three different sources a piece of information before you decide that it's real. In my long experience with New Zealand First, I have never been aware that Mr. Haumaha had anything to do with New Zealand First. So that was news to me.
Right, right. And is that the general consensus across New Zealand First?
Well, I don't know. I, as a minister who was required by the cabinet to appoint an independent chair of an independent government inquiry, I didn't go and canvass New Zealand First because that's not what I'm here to do.
Right.
If we go back to the opposition statements about, so they've made several statements. I mean, let's just remember that this is a opposition that gave the gentleman that they are criticising two awards. So they gave him some of the highest honours in New Zealand. And so they need to, you know, I think they need to be a little bit circumspect there. But with regard to whether we've taken too long to put this inquiry together or not, it took 15 days to actually from the moment we said we would have an independent government inquiry to the process that I had to take with the Department of Internal Affairs to find a chair that would drop everything in their lives and dedicate themselves to 6 weeks to finding out the information we need from this inquiry. And, you know, people do have lives. So it took 15 days, I think, from
well, that is impressive, yeah.
to put it together, you know.
So you'd say that the National Party statements are probably quite political.
Oh, they are political. I mean, you know, they're the opposition, and that's okay. So, I mean, I understand it, but I just think that they need to be a little bit careful that they don't also look somewhat hypocritical.
Right. Okay. All right, moving on. New Zealand First did hit a 25-year anniversary mark, which is quite impressive. So they're now New Zealand's third longest surviving party.
I know.
Would you say that now New Zealand First is at the strongest it's ever been?
I think we are. I mean, I think we are from the perspective that, you know, every new political party, and you've seen them, it's hard to get traction, and it's hard to actually make sure that you keep your profile up in a country that is, strangely enough, still trying to figure out the difference between first past the post and MMP.
Yeah.
And I make that statement because how many times are we seeing in the paper that this is a Labour-led government? Whereas actually it's a coalition government. We're not following Labour. We are collegially sitting down at a cabinet table with them and coordinating with Labour's supply and confidence partner, the Greens, to come up with policy and legislation for what we believe is the better direction for New Zealand. But the media still can't figure that out, you know, that this is actually an MMP environment. It's probably the first truly MMP government.
Reflecting on New Zealand First, do you think, in terms of policy and what the party stands for, do you think that much has changed over the last 25 years?
Well, the 15 founding principles are still there.
Mm-hmm.
And we still, I mean, I know, for example, when we get to contentious issues where what I like about my caucus is we don't all come from just this one philosophical bent, okay? Mm. So I know when we have had contentious issues that we've had extreme right views expressed, extreme left, and, you know, there's a whole lot of us in the middle. So because we don't just come from one particular narrative, we go back to our 15 founding principles quite often to say, well, okay, what would the people who voted for us want us to do based on the values that we, you know, we have stood for? So those founding principles are still as valid today as they were 25 years ago.
Do you think having some in the caucus who are a little bit more right-leaning, some who are a little bit left-leaning, that can be a bit confusing for the voters?
No, because what it does is, we stand for the policies. So what it does is it actually means that we get, we're more reflective of New Zealand, I personally think. We don't, you know, of all New Zealand. Because we sit down there and we thrash out what is actually the best reasonable, responsible decision for New Zealand with all those views sitting at the table. I really like the fact that we have those strong conversations and get to a consensus decision phase, you know, which is a little bit different from the dictatorship I'm supposed to be working in.
seeing the party strong, I mean, one day Winston Peters will have to call it quits. Do you think now is as good a time as ever for him to leave confidently with the party able to thrive? I mean, looking at other New Zealand parties, for example, when Richard Preble resigned from ACT, it took a really great leader in Hyde to sort of to keep the
really?
Party going.
A really
well,
great,
I wouldn't
really
say really great,
great
leader.
Leader.
I mean, a personality, definitely a personality.
Yes, definitely a personality. Now that's something.
Do you think
too,
that New Zealand First needs something like that?
Well, this is the thing, because I actually had Henry Cook from the media ask me about who would be the next leader, because a leader needs to get media attention, needs to be a character, and so on and so forth. Really? Is that what a leader needs to be? I would say to you that a leader needs to be a person who can bring people together, who has the ability to take people along with decisions with them, to be able to interact intelligently with a vast variety of different members of New Zealand society. So
I think in the current political landscape, it takes
a
bit of both.
Well, I think we're getting into personality politics. We have started to, and the media has driven that. They started to drive like presidential campaigns. So it started with slightly with Helen Clark, and then it really, you know, accelerated under John Key, that this became about personality.
Yeah.
And for some bizarre reason, nobody considers that. Well, okay, tell me, if Simon Bridges went tomorrow, who would replace him?
Exactly. Well, I mean, I think in the National Party there are a few.